Well, hello, friends. Welcome to the Alabama Liberal Podcast. Today, we have a special treat. We have Mike Breuer, who's in the Kentucky Senate race. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Breuer.
Oh, hey, Brody, please, Mike. And it's great to be here, and I really appreciate you setting some time aside to talk to me.
I want to talk about your biography and your platforms and some of your issues, but I feel like I owe you an apology right off the bat, because I actually learned that Mitch McConnell is from Alabama. And I learned that recently, and I was horrified to learn it. But he's from Athens, Alabama, which is not that far from where I'm from.
Do you want him back?
Yep. I wish we could have stopped him from moving in the first place. Tell people, Alabama's a lot cooler than you think. For every Octavia Spencer and Tim Cook, there may be a Jeff Sessions, but we're still, you know, pretty cool state. When you look at Mitch McConnell, I mean, his first election, he won in 1984. I was born in 1986. I'm going to be 34 at the end of May. So he's been in the Senate my entire lifetime. And I always hear people say things like, we don't like the establishment, or we want term limits, or don't like career politicians. But I look at that and think, 36 years in the Senate is a damn long time.
You know, he and I entered federal service the exact same year. I joined the Marine Corps and went on active duty, and I went on active duty in 84, and he went to U.S. Senate, and one of us is a multi-millionaire, and one of us is an asparagus farmer in Chicken Bristle, Kentucky.
So your background is so fascinating, because you were a member of the Marines, and you're a farmer, and you do some substitute teaching, which I thought was really neat, because I used to be a substitute teacher, and look at your jobs as a teacher and a member of the Marine Corps and a farmer, and obviously the Southeast has a big military presence, a lot of farmers, a lot of teachers. You seem to have more of the jobs that people in Kentucky actually do. And Mitch McConnell, when he got out of law school, almost immediately went into political campaigns and then the Senate. He really has become a career politician, and I think his life experience may be quite different from the way most people in Kentucky live.
Well, if you go back to even in high school, he was a politician. He talks in his biography very proudly about lining up the cheerleaders and the football players and getting them on his side to get him elected. And is like, oh, this is kind of creepy, you know?
You mentioned your service in the Marine Corps, but Mitch McConnell famously got a draft deferment. He had an educational draft deferment when he was in college. Then the second he got out, he went into the Army Reserve, which kind of kept him out of Vietnam. 5 weeks into the Army Reserves, he had a medical discharge for an inflamed optic nerve. You know, everybody makes fun of him because of his big Coke bottle glasses and the turtle shell glasses. That actually got him out of his military service, so he only spent 5 weeks or so in the Army Reserves. Do you think that's a service to be proud of, especially contrasted with yours?
If the whole thing's kind of a joke, you know, and people want to talk about it and tell me, hey, you should talk about this on the campaign trail, but I just look at it as a complete absence of service. You know, you dodge a draft, and funnily, a lot of the documentation regarding his service is missing. Particularly, his father had written a letter to the commanding general of the base he was training at and said that he needed to be expeditiously discharged because he had to report to law school, Columbia or something like that. I think it was Columbia. And he hadn't even applied to Columbia. Never applied, never was accepted.
Right.
And that was one of the few pieces of documentation that actually survived the great McConnell military junket. But I'm also married to a retired Marine, too. My wife's a retired Marine as well. Her dad was a Marine. My dad was a Marine. It's kind of a family illness, so...
A lot of Southern people have a military background. I don't know a lot, that many people in the Southeast who don't have either a family member or a friend or somebody they know personally who was, like you said, my dad was in the Army, my granddad was in the Navy. People that were in my high school class, unfortunately, they had to go serve in the Iraq War, and noticed that a lot of candidates like McConnell and Trump, who also got a lot of Vietnam draft deferments, they seem very eager to put other people in harm's way than them to be in the wars. Themselves, they're not so eager on that.
No, and of course, the president had his own the Vietnam, dealing with battling STDs and during the disco era. And
right.
I mean, how do people even say stuff like that out loud? You know?
Right,
I mean,
sure.
Even if you're in your head. I mean, talk about having no impulse control. To your original point, though, I think, which was the fact that I was a teacher. I've taught to adjunct faculty member for the Command Staff, Marine Corps Command Staff College, adjunct faculty at the University of California for 3 years. And substitute teaching. And so I like to tell people I taught every grade from kindergarten through college. But it goes a long way in Kentucky. And honestly, I guess to your point, when I was thinking about running against Mitch McConnell, and you were saying, gosh, you've had him for so long, he's never run against a retired combat veteran. He's never run against a teacher. He's never run against a farmer. I mean, someone with the dirt of Kentucky under his fingernails. People always say, oh, is this some kind of ego project? But no, I mean, I think he poses an existential threat to the Republic. And as someone who swore to protect and defend the Constitution, and I started looking at this going, you know, I've got the resume cuts a wide swath across Kentucky. There's not anybody in Kentucky who is not akin to a teacher, a veteran, or a farmer. When you look at the demographics of Kentucky, and yeah, they've been sending Mitch for 35 years. We've been sending him to D.C., but it's time for a change. And his approval rate in Kentucky is as low as it is across the country. So I looked at my resume and said, you know what? I've got one more good fight in me, and this is a fight worth winning. And so my wife and I, you know, we talked about this about a year ago, and then we just jumped in.
Listening to you talk, I can tell that you do feel that it is a patriotic duty to run for office and serve against. Kentucky's state motto is United we stand, divided we fall. And off the top of my head, I can't think of a more obstructionist politician than Mitch McConnell, somebody more actively dividing us. It's a Kentucky race, and it's inside the borders of Kentucky, but in a way, it's almost a national race because there's not a Democrat you can talk to who doesn't know who he is, usually in a very negative context. You almost have to wonder, you know, how can Kentucky, which is really known for being a very, I would say, pragmatic state, and I think when he initially started, I'm reading this off his Wikipedia page, but it said when he initially went into Congress, he was a more pragmatic, moderate politician, and now, of course, is the exact opposite. He's the leading obstructionist pretty much out there, kind of the face of that in the country. So when it's united, we stand, divided, we fall inside Kentucky. It almost looks like he's not reflecting the values of the people who live in Kentucky.
You're absolutely right. You know, when he started off, he was actually supported originally by the pro-choice folks and by organized labor. I mean, he had their support, and he went to D.C. and just within his first 6 years just burned every bridge with them. Yet he keeps getting sent back and back and back. And I don't think he reflects the values of people in Kentucky. And I think one thing about people in Kentucky, they've got a real keen sense of fair play. Lately, I think this particular last term, even people who consider themselves to be, you know, conservative, socially conservative people, they just do not like what they're seeing. And he has very, very, there's no enthusiasm for him here. He can deliver some pork, particularly considering his wife is the Secretary of Transportation. I mean, he can parachute in a highway bypass if you need one, but he is so far distant from the people of Kentucky that when I considered running, I was like, you know what? I've got the resume to beat this guy. And that's what I've been doing since when I kicked this thing off, just going to every place, going to every Democratic Women's Club that would have me, and the Indivisibles have been hugely supportive. And anytime someone said, hey, do you want to go talk? I said, I'm on my way. It's been a great connection. Of course, the uphill battle is name recognition. I was talking to a lady in New York today, and she says, well, who the heck are you? How come I haven't heard about you? And, you know, I say, well, I'm not the Democratic Party's choice, not getting the media and the airtime.
Mitch McConnell, since he's been in the Senate, he's changed positions. Like you said, he was more of a moderate. He's changed all his positions. He's changed wives because he was married to somebody else, then divorced, now married to Elaine Chao, who's Trump's Secretary of Transportation. When you look at somebody who's in Trump's cabinet, and then he's been in D.C. for 36 years, he hasn't really lived in Kentucky in decades. And you can almost say they're a D.C.-based power couple who occasionally go to Kentucky to campaign. But you're saying, hey, man, my wife, we're both in the Marines. We're literal farmers. We've got the dirt of Kentucky under our fingernails. You actually live there. I think makes you so much more connected to how ordinary Kentuckians actually live their lives.
Sure. And you know, when I talk about issues, in fact, poor and the working class people in Kentucky, I know of what I speak because we are farmers. Whether it's the impact of climate change or the loss of the family farm, pollution from mines or, you know, we've got the third worst air pollution in the country, which is hard to imagine, but it's from our coal-fired power plants and it causes our health problems. And whether it's in rural Kentucky out east in Appalachia or in the cities like Louisville and Lexington, these are issues that go, I think one thing Mitch is good at is cultivating, putting people in boxes and making them fight each other. You know, my campaign's been, no, listen, we have way more in common and we can address these broader issues and improve everyone's quality of life. And that's what this campaign's been about. And, you know, people say, how do you beat Mitch McConnell? You know, my answer always is you just beat him with the unrelenting truth.
When you go to MikeForKentucky.com, and I encourage people to do it, you can see your platforms talk much more directly to what Southern people and Kentucky people are actually going through. You're talking about health care, and you're talking about, you mentioned being a farmer last year, farm bankruptcies hit an all-time high. A lot of farmers are really hurting under Trump's economy. Talking about things that Kentuckians actually can relate to. You look at Mitch McConnell, he's talking about a tax cut for corporations. Now, how does that help most people who live in Kentucky? A lot of your issues, they're healthcare related. And of course, healthcare is a huge problem in the South. That used to, a lot of people, they get sick, they're kind of screwed. Right now with coronavirus, we're seeing it sweep. The hospitals in Georgia, the rural hospitals, they're overflowing. New Orleans may have more deaths than New York within a couple of weeks. Alabama just had their first coronavirus death. It really looks like you're ahead of the curve on a lot of stuff that's actually going to be more and more important going into November.
I'll tell you, one of the things that was just fortunate timing was, you know, I've embraced universal basic income. And when I started talking about it, you know, it was just that kind of that thing that Andrew Yang was running on. You know, that was just the, you know, that Mitch McConnell called it a left-wing dream sheet or something like that. Now you've got the Wall Street Journal editorial board, and you've got Mitt Romney, and you know, bless his heart, and you know what we say in the South, we say bless his heart, but bless his heart,
right, sure.
Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump thinking, hey, maybe we should be sending checks to people every month. And of course they're doing it to save their jobs. I was pushing it because it was a social and economic justice issue. They're pushing it now because November's coming.
Yeah, right. I'm sure you noticed that whenever a Democrat takes the White House, all the deficit hawks come out. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we can't spend money on this. We don't have money for that. And the second Republicans in there, Reagan and Bush, they all had sky-high deficits. It seems like it's not going to be a problem until Biden gets in there, and then there'll be a recession and a deficit, and they'll be like, hey, we got to do something about this under Obama's whole presidency. Oh, we don't have money for that. We can't spend on this. Now Trump's like, hey, we got to spend $3 trillion to bail out Wall Street. We, you know, like all these nickels are suddenly available. Carnival Cruise Lines can be built out, and Delta Airlines can be built out, which they already had a huge tax cut not 2 years ago, but $1,200 checks just for me to keep me from starving to death, that's too much money, and we don't have it. There just seems to be a huge disconnect between what we're willing to spend money on and what we need to spend money on.
The NASDAQ or the S&P or the performance on Wall Street, you know, people in Kentucky's eyes gloss over. They're like, I don't have a 401k. You know, I'm trying to, you know, people farm at night and on weekends because they want to farm. They love farming, but they got to work off the farm because you got to keep the farm afloat. And again, someone who lives out here in the country and sees it every single day, you're absolutely right. These are issues that are very, very important to Kentuckians. And, you know, let me tell you something. I was, one thing you might have picked up my resume was, but I was also the editor of our rural weekly newspaper for 3 years here in Lincoln County. And one of the things that when they were trying to kill the Obamacare, trying to kill the ACA, I think it was back in 2010. So I was interviewing people and they said, we don't need that Obamacare because Mitch McConnell got us Connect. And Connect is the exchange for the ACA in Kentucky. And I swear, people literally told me that Mitch McConnell got them that. And that is the thing he was trying to do. You know, we moved over 250,000 Kentuckians onto insurance. You know, through the ACA, I think close to 400,000 Kentuckians got health insurance for the first time. But it's that special voodoo that McConnell can do and trick people into thinking, you know, I wanted to slam my head in the car door when I heard that. I was like, well, no. Connect is Obamacare. But people didn't want to hear it.
All these stories about people don't want Obamacare, but they like the Affordable Health Care Act. Same thing, as long as you don't call it that. If it's called Romneycare, they like it. If it's called Obamacare, they hate it.
Right.
And in Alabama, we had a governor, Robert Bentley, during Obama's, most of the time he was in office. And during the recession, Obama, he wanted to do a Medicaid expansion. Bentley turned that down. He wanted to do an unemployment expansion. Bentley turned that down. He wanted to do a stimulus package in Alabama. Bentley turned that down. 2 weeks later, why is Obama not doing anything for Alabama? Why are they not helping out Alabama? And he's trying to, but the Republican governor is saying no to everything. And Obama's trying to give him money, and he says, get away from me. That money's got germs. I don't want it.
Let me ask my host a question.
Sure.
What do you
think
it is?
I know what it is, but I know that, and you can see such a difference. When Matt Bevin's the governor, people are losing their health care, and now that the Beshears, people are getting health care. Luckily, you have a decent governor right now. We don't.
Yeah.
Kentucky, I think you'll see a better coronavirus response than Alabama has with KIP. He literally gave a press conference saying, hey, we're not L.A., we're not New York, we're not affected by this. Now there's 300 cases in Alabama because she didn't want to close the state down. And in a way, Alabama is almost the mirror opposite of Kentucky in that you have a good governor and two purple senators, and we have Doug Jones and the terrible governor. You know, all these people saying Mitch McConnell, he's too powerful, he can't be beaten. Keep in mind, they said that about Doug Jones in Alabama, that he couldn't take that seat, Roy Moore was going to win. I can sense some of your frustration with the national media, and I share that a lot too. And the Doug Jones race, they're all saying Doug Jones is dead. He doesn't have a chance. It's going to be Roy Moore. I mean, the New York Times basically declared Roy Moore the winner 2 weeks before the race. And people like me who were actually new Alabamians and were like, no, Roy Moore's lost two governor's races. He's not as popular as you think. And then Doug Jones wins. And I'm hoping something very similar like that will happen against McConnell, where everybody declares the Democratic candidate dead, like, oh, Kentucky, he can't win. There's no way. And then there's a November surprise.
Yeah, it will be a great gift for the nation. I mean, honestly, it's the other part of it is, you know, I do have a primary race, and the DSCC has picked someone else and endorsed someone else. But, you know, that's okay. I like, you know, one thing is about running without being the party choice or without taking super PAC money or dark money. You don't owe anybody. And it's incredibly liberating. When I started my campaign, it was just like, there's not going to be any focus groups. There's not going to be any triangulation. There's not going to be any hair splitting or equivocating. It's just like, you've been to my website. I mean, that's basically a gut spill. This is how I feel about stuff. I'm 58 years old. I've got a job I like. I don't, I'm not padding my resume because I don't think I'll ever need a resume ever again. Unless I become a greeter at Walmart someday, you know, I won't need a resume. It was an opportunity just to let it all hang out. And people say that you can't run as progressive in Kentucky, but we've been running very, very centrist, moderate Democrats against Mitch McConnell for 35 years, and we get creamed every single time. So you want to get people excited, you want them to come out and vote, then stand for something. And even if a Kentuckian doesn't agree with you, they will appreciate your honesty. You know, it's a pretty low bar. I met some farmers up in northern Kentucky one day, and one of the guys said, I got one question, you know, are you pro-life or pro-choice? And I said, well, you're going to be disappointed, but I'm, you know, I'm pro-choice. And he kind of smacked his hands down the table, and he said, well, I disagree with you, but at least you didn't lie to me, so you got my vote. That's all you have to do. You know, tell the truth and not lie to people. And I'm convinced that you can communicate progressive ideas in a very conservative place like Kentucky. And I kind of learned that as a newspaper editor. You know, I wrote probably over 100 editorials in my career. And you got to be right. And you got to be patient. And you can't talk down to people. You know, you make someone feel dumb. You start to lecture them. Then they turn off. You know, I learned that working for, you know, working on the newspaper, talking every single week to, you know, my readers, and in the country, that weekly rural newspaper, that's the paper. It's not the New York Times. It's not the Washington Post. It's the paper is your county or local weekly newspaper, and that's where they get their news.
Kind of building on what you're saying, I believe the Southeast is a lot more progressive than people give it credit for being, and that they realize that's why Alabama Liberal, our tagline is blue in a red state. I estimate probably 40% of Alabama is Democratic. It's just that they may not vote. Sometimes they're not able to vote. They just don't turn out like the Republicans do necessarily. But Alabama, until 2010, we had a Democratic state house and state senate. And I know Kentucky, their state senate was the very last chamber that the Southeast controlled during Obama's presidency. It's not a blood red state at all. I mean, it's not Nebraska. I think it's definitely conceivable that a Democrat can win in Alabama, in Kentucky or Alabama. Depends on the candidate. And like you're saying, the great thing about Southern progressives, we're not viewed the same way Bernie Sanders is. Like, people look at Bernie and think, oh, he's a communist or whatever. John Edwards was talking about the exact same stuff Bernie Sanders was, but nobody viewed him the way that they did. They're like, oh, John Edwards, he's a centrist Democrat. He was to the left of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton on everything. But people didn't realize it because it was like, well, he's from the Southeast. There's no way he could be that liberal.
No, I agree. And I don't want to overgeneralize, but family is important, and family farms are important, and connections with the community is important. And none of these things are represented, as you pointed out earlier, by Mitch McConnell and people like him. I think hopefully the days of people just, you know, voting straight party are past. And I think that there's a lot of, you know, we have more registered Democrats in Kentucky than we do Republicans. That means they've been either not voting, or it's a mixture of them not voting or voting for Mitch McConnell. And I think that they, you know, like a real honest progressive campaign, I can get the Democrats who are not excited out to the polls, and I can win over those Republicans that I need to. And I think we can just show them that their lives are no better and are demonstrably worse having Mitch McConnell as Senate Majority Leader. And you mentioned it earlier. You said, well, there's all this prestige. Doesn't mean nothing to people in Kentucky. Their lives are no better because he's a Senate Majority Leader. And I think he has contempt for the people of Kentucky.
I think you're absolutely right.
I mean, take a look at the way he treated the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. People who are supported by that trust fund are his constituents. They're not like some people in far-flung state out west. These are people in Kentucky. Funding for that lapse, the sad part of it, I guess, is that keeping that fund afloat has fallen on the taxpayers. We've transferred the cost of that should be borne by the coal industry onto you and I, who haven't made a penny off of it. The days of heading out to eastern Kentucky saying, we're bringing coal back, boys. I don't think a politician who says that is going to make it out of a holler. He tries that one again.
Right.
People out there are eager for change, and they want to be part of a green economy. You know, they want to be brought into this century, and they deserve to be.
Right.
I can say with all honesty that the coal from coal producing states of Appalachia built the great cities, the railroads, the bridges, the infrastructure of this country. And it's up all responsibility to bring them along and make them whole, because they literally have been left holding the bag economically and ecologically for, you know, almost two decades of coal production.
Of course, Trump, he ran on this idea that we're going to bring the coal jobs back, and he's taken all these huge contributions from Peabody Energy and the Murray Coal Company. He takes all these contributions from coal companies, and they use that to automate those jobs. It's not creating any jobs because they're just automating even further to lock the coal miners out.
And it's definitely a diminishing. Now, we have coal fields in Western Kentucky as well, but you talk to the folks who are mining in Appalachian, they'll tell you that they used to mine seams high as the room I'm in, and now they're down to mining seams that are 18 inches high. These are not dumb guys. You know, they can literally see it petering out. And so they want to be part of an economy that's going forward. I want to bring them along.
Talking about how disconnected Mitch McConnell may be from the way Kentuckians live their lives, when he was 2 years old, he had a bout of polio and almost left him permanently paralyzed. And he had to go to a Roosevelt clinic FDR started in Warm Springs, Georgia, to get medical treatment for that. Think about, well, he could have died when he was 2 years old. He had a serious medical illness. He's talked about that it almost bankrupted his family, that his family had severe medical debt to treat his polio. You look at that, you think, your own personal experience, you should be able to see what people are talking about with these health care bills. And yet the empathy just doesn't translate at all to other people.
You nailed it. It's a complete lack of empathy. I mean, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's,
right.
I think, cares about consolidating power in D.C. and making money, whether it's, you know, of course, polio is, you know, almost gone in the world. It may make a comeback, but that lack of empathy when you suffered a childhood disease and you cannot understand. He's told interviewers, he said, yeah, it almost bankrupted my family. But he doesn't care that another common childhood disease will literally bankrupt a family these days, and you could be on the street. And that lack of empathy is startling. And, you know, we talked about values we perceive to be as Southern. Communities get together. I'm sure it is the same place in Alabama when something bad happens. Everyone pitches together. There's, you know, chip-in money at the convenience stores and have sales and fundraisers. And now I guess people do GoFundMe and things like that. But that shouldn't be the way you get healthcare in America. It's just communicating that to potential voters saying, no, this isn't right. That, you know, you shouldn't have to be collecting nickels at the Circle K to get your kid treatment for your childhood leukemia.
Bad part about the coronavirus strike in the Southeast right now, this is tornado season. Pretty much every April, it seems like we have a massive tornado come through, and already this couldn't be a worse time to have a plague or, you know, some kind of coronavirus where people are afraid to go to the hospital, or a hospital could be damaged or it could be shut down. It might not be open. But talking about how little Mitch McConnell's done, Jeff Sessions, he was the Alabama senator for a long time. Now he's running for re-election this year after Trump gave him the boot. And it just reminded me that every time there was a huge tornado or a big crisis, he never would come. He'd never come from D.C., or if he ever did, he'd go to Mobile or one of the cities that wasn't really even affected by it. He'd give a press conference, and then he'd leave. I'm sure McConnell's response has been basically the same way. In Kentucky, they have a natural disaster, and it's almost like, where is this guy?
The last public appearance he made was a couple of weeks ago. We've got a Asian carp problem in a lot of the big game fishing waters here in Kentucky, and he got some money for a federal program to remove Asian carp from some of the big lakes. And so that was his. He was out there in a boat, seeing Mitch McConnell out in a boat as they're, you know, herding these Asian carps in the big nets and stuff like that. Just kind of gratuitous, but he's not going to be here when people are in trouble. He was out there currying favor with who he perceives as, you know, the sportsmen are going to vote for him because he got rid of the Asian carp. I mean, it's just completely, the bad man in me was praying, because these Asian carp jump out of the water when they're scared. And the bad man side of me is praying that one of those big giant ones is going to wallop him right in the head, knock him in the water. Does that make me a bad man?
Yeah. No, I don't. No, I mean, I think seeing him be reelected over and over again, I'm very hopeful about 2020, because if you think about it, like, more people generally vote in presidential election years than midterm election years. So you're already going to have bigger turnout because of the Trump-Biden race, or, you know, the presidential race is going to bring a lot more people out. Biden is a lot more popular in Kentucky than Hillary Clinton was. He has older voters, rural voters, working class voters kind of like him a little bit better. The demographics are more favorable. And you had Mitch McConnell, who's been in the Senate for 36 years. His wife lives in D.C. He doesn't live here. He barely comes here. So if he doesn't make a post look at that, it's almost surprising he's lasted this long. But especially this year with this much turnout and an almost guaranteed recession about to begin, but the demographics are very favorable for you.
You're absolutely right. You know, he's very little connection. And other than this ability to deliver some pork in election year, and even the pork's kind of tainted these days. I don't know if you were tracking the you know, we are now, the taxpayers of Kentucky are now business partners with Oleg Deripaska. I'll give you the nickel version of it. It's that, like, within 72 hours of the Senate allowing sanctions against Deripaska, the Russian oligarch, to expire, all of a sudden, Rusal was investing in $600 million in a aluminum processing plant or pressing plant here in northeastern Kentucky. The even sadder part of it was the end of the fiscal year for our state government. Bevin rushes in and says, you need to pony up $15 million for this business or they're going to go elsewhere, which was patently untrue. This was a deal that was cut for McConnell. So our state government voted $15 million in cash, and the only money that so far appeared for this processing plant, Eastern Kentucky, is the $15 million that the taxpayers of Kentucky ponied up. And they're saying it's going to cost, at least another $500 million before they even start moving dirt. It made a big splash. It made a lot of news. Mitch McConnell got us his plant here, and we got nothing. So I remind people of Kentucky, and like I said, it cost us $15 million that we probably are never going to get back. I don't know if they're growing hemp down in Alabama, but it's been kind of a disaster here. And people, 9 months ago was, or a year ago now, it was, you know, Mitch McConnell rammed through legislation to allow us to grow hemp. There are a lot of farmers here with barns full of hemp they can't sell. And, all you got to do is you go out to Western Kentucky and you mention hemp, and people will be happy to take you out to their barn and show you all their unsold hemp. And since it's a non-traditional crop, they couldn't get your typical loan, so they've refinanced the farm or they mortgaged your house.
McConnell, of course, is famously against marijuana. He doesn't want legalized marijuana. Very, very against it. But he'll let people grow hemp, and you almost wonder, like, what's really behind that? Because it's not because Mitch McConnell is some big believer in hemp all of a sudden.
Well, yeah, people are making money. The biggest hemp buyer here in Kentucky, a company called Jankana, went bankrupt 6 weeks ago, and they posted $100 million in debt when they went bankrupt. The money went somewhere, right? All the investors, people made money. The people who sold the seed stock, they made their money. The early investors made their money, and the people holding the bag are the farmers in Kentucky that jumped in on this. So we haven't heard the McConnell camp bragging about what they've done for hemp lately, because it's here, at least, it's a disaster.
It would really be beneficial to have you go to the Senate, because I feel like almost no senators are from a farming background. You see the farmers in Iowa that have the soybeans. These soybeans that they can't sell, they can't do anything with. They're basically just rotting away in these barns. And now you're saying the same thing about hemp in Kentucky. It just seems like a lot of the Republican Party, they encourage people to grow crops that they can't sell. Be helpful to have somewhat of a farming background to know actually, like, okay, here's how farms actually work.
Well, and the, you know, the trade wars don't help, you know.
Sure.
Picking ridiculous fights with China, number one purchaser of soybeans. And that's why, like, the universal basic income, because I think that small farmers are, by definition, small farms are more diversified. It lends itself to food security. And also, they're better for the environment. When you go to monoculture, when you start doing industrial scale farming, you know, it's all Monsanto. It's Roundup and GMOs. And, they're one bad harvest away from people starving.
In North Alabama, the part I'm from, they made a lot of deals in that part of Alabama, and then they all screwed them. Basically, everybody who made deals with them got screwed over. Yeah, their name is Mud. I know what you're saying, where it's almost like some of these huge agrochemical companies, they're really more chemical companies than farming companies and agricultural companies. Their name value in rural South is worthless because of what they've done. Also, part of Alabama I'm from, there's a lot of poultry. So you have Tyson and Goldkist and Purdue, and a lot of my family, they made their money in chicken farming.
Yeah, and what you hear about the chicken farming is, typically, I hear people say, I just got out from underneath my contract with Purdue.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, and then with Tyson, they would do these ridiculous contracts. My mom's, her uncle and her whole family were chicken farmers. Take it, we get on Social Security or something comparable to UBI, like, we couldn't wait to sell it. The contracts were terrible. We couldn't make any money. We were constantly in debt. Some of them had health problems, respiratory problems, and pulmonary things because you're breathing all that stuff in and everything. I mean, it's exactly what you're saying.
Well, you know, when you were mentioning that not too many representatives having a farming background, back in, I guess it was, I was still editing the newspaper, and they were going to redistrict 2010, and they were going to reach all the way across Kentucky from the first district, which is out, touches the Mississippi River, and they were going to come across here and make a congressional district that included my county, which is, like, definitely central, you know, eastern Kentucky. And so as a newspaper editor, I was going to interview the guy who was going to be possibly our new congressman, a guy named Ed Whitfield. He did a couple of terms. I think he probably did 7 or 8 terms as first district congressman. I said, well, you know, Representative Whitfield, I noticed that you're not on any agricultural committees. He said, farming bores me. And I was like, trying to be fair, I said, almost every one of my readers here is farmer. Thought about it for me, he goes, but I'm starting to get really interested in it. But literally, this guy is going to have, he's going to cut all the way across southern Kentucky, the real breadbasket of Kentucky, and he had no interest in farming whatsoever. It's startling, but I think that's going to be, a key part of my campaign is reaching out to people who earn their living farming.
That's what's so interesting about your campaign, because typically, Republican voting blocs are farmers and people in the military. So it's almost, if you can reach those, you're already going to get the Democratic votes. But if you can flip some of those others, that's how you beat McConnell. And that's because in Alabama, pretty much the most reliable voting blocs for Republicans are evangelicals and people in the military and farmers themselves. But I have to think farmers have looked at the last couple of years and think, wow, a record number of farm bankruptcies. That maybe happens when you have a president who's is a weirdo and was raised in the glass tower in New York. Trump's a germaphobe. He's not a person of nature. He doesn't like being out in nature. He barely left New York City as a kid and growing up. Kyle, you're talking about who wasn't that interested in farming. I have to think Trump's really not interested in farming. He really doesn't care about it necessarily and get involved in it.
It wasn't maybe 3-4 months ago where it was Sonny Perdue. It was Secretary of Agriculture. He was at a farm forum. I think he was in Iowa, of all places. And people were talking about the trade wars and the effects, and he just said, you have a bad business model, you small businessmen, you're small farmers, so you either get bigger, get out. And you're talking to a room full of farmers who, literally people who farm at night and farm all weekend and do other things during the week. Right. They want to be farmers, and he's going to tell them that you need to sell your farm and go work full-time at the factory and shut up. And that's coming from that particular spectacular tone deafness. Now that we're all hung up on pandemics and stuff, people aren't talking about environmental change. And, small farms are intrinsically better for the environment. We have an all-natural asparagus farm. That's our crop. That's what we do here. And by the way, I spotted the first ones today. Picking begins tomorrow, I guess. We do our operation here, and we make good profit off it. But the way we do it by hand and without using chemicals and without using pesticides and mechanical, blasting the earth dry and mechanical harvesting, we pick it all by hand. You don't make nearly as much money, but it's better for the environment and it's better for people's health. You produce healthier food and you're not damaged. We don't have runoff going into the creeks and, causing algal blooms and killing the fish. All those things, second and third order effects of crappy industrial farming techniques.
I've heard different people and talk about sustainable farming. It's almost not encouraged. It's almost like from a government perspective, don't do it that way.
Absolutely. When you hear farm bailouts, you're not talking to a guy with 50, 75 acres. You're talking to somebody with 1,000, 5,000 acres. Big company can absorb a brief hit, but a small farmer cannot. And they're out of business, and their farm is for sale. We have a lot of small farms that have gone bust here, but we have a large influx of Amish and Mennonite coming in from Ohio and Pennsylvania. But they have a different business model. There are some good businessmen. They're doing organic dairying is kind of the mainstay. And it'll be interesting to see how involved they get with the community, because if they're doing their organic certified, they can't use crops that have had chemical pesticides used on them. And that means they're neighbors. And so it's going to be interesting as this plays out. But I'm happy to see that at least some of the farms are being saved by people who are more traditional in the way they go about their farming.
And Kentucky's primary is at the end. Have they moved it from the end of May, or is it still going to be around that time?
It's moved out into June now. So okay. June 23rd.
Make sure you remember Mike Breuer and Mitch McConnell. If he was defeated in November, in a way, it would almost be as sweet as Trump. He existed before Trump. Obama famously couldn't get Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court. He's the obstructionist in chief. He just wants to block all these Supreme Court picks. And even if he still controls the Senate and Joe Biden's president, I could see him being like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Well, we have to wait till 2024 to allow a vote. I mean, I could see him doing the same thing. His accountability just doesn't exist. And the voters in Kentucky will make it exist.
The only people who can really determine this are the voters in Kentucky. But even if we take the White House, if we do not beat Mitch McConnell, even if we didn't say we didn't flip the Senate, and I listened to your program flipping the Senate, even if we didn't flip the Senate, just get rid of Mitch McConnell, because I don't think anyone would have the stones to stand up and do the things he says, because there will be repercussions. And so knocking him out, is top priority, because he will, if he maintains the control, maintains controls of the Senate, we're going to see the same, we're going to have six more years of this stuff. And I don't think the Republican can survive it.
And I give you like an example with me when Tom Daschle, Democrats, he was the Senate Majority Leader, and then he got beat in South Dakota. And after he did, you saw Democrats be a lot more willing to work with Republicans. Well, the reverse of that could happen this time. If you see Mitch McConnell lose a general election, you know, whoever the next minority leader in the Senate, I bet they're going to be a little bit more cooperative with Democrats after such a big message being sent, like, we don't want obstruction anymore.
Having to hear Mitch McConnell talk about now it's time for us to work together, we need bipartisanship, makes me kind of want to kind of makes me want to gag.
Right.
Because when you hear that out of Mitch McConnell's mouth, you know he is fighting for his life, and we're bringing it. Well, you know, we're bringing it to him every single day. And if your listeners want to go check out my website, mikeforky.com, mikeforky.com. There's a if they go /sign up, there's a way they can help. Phone banking, digital, people in Kentucky can get yard signs and stuff like that. But also, as usual, there's a big donate button. And right now we're kind of up against the, no, we are not kind of, we're absolutely up against the end of the reporting quarter. And I would much rather have $1,001 donors than one $1,000 donor, because it shows grassroots. And I think it really shows enthusiasm, which is what my campaign is about.
Sure. When you were saying that about, you know, McConnell talking about working together and everything, it's been interesting to see him handle this coronavirus crisis, because on the one hand, you know, when it first started, he was almost like, well, we'll vote on it sometime next week. And, you know, he was moving real slow. It didn't seem
he wanted to take a vacation.
Like you said, a vacation. And then it just wasn't urgent. Nancy Pelosi passed it. She's like, okay, are you going to vote on this? And they're like, well, next week we'll get to it, whatever. He must have went and looked at some poll numbers, because when he came back, oh, this is urgent, we got to act now. I mean, it's like there was a fire under his ass that just didn't exist. I'm thinking he saw some poll numbers that scared him, and that's the only reason he started to act fast.
Well, you know, he took a long weekend. He came here to Kentucky with Brett Kavanaugh, of all people. They came here for a long weekend because he'd rammed through another unqualified federal judge, and they came out here to, I guess the guy had clerked for Kavanaugh at one point, and so they came out here to celebrate this. He spent a 3-day weekend, literally, I mean, Rome is burning, and he's here kicking it with Brett Kavanaugh and another flunky judge. And so,
as a future senator, do you find it uncomfortable that a Supreme Court justice would be coming to Kentucky during an election year? I find that to be very queasy.
It's certainly untoward, you know, and it doesn't have good appearances, but as we said several times today, he doesn't care how it looks. He doesn't care. But I think he saw those numbers, and all of a sudden, this spurt of bipartisanship is, he's seen the numbers. And,
you know, you hear people say Moscow Mitch, like you were talking about with the deals with Russia and everything, and he's so connected to Russia, and he voted against sanctions, famously voted against sanctions. Joe Scarborough called him Moscow Mitch, former Republican calling him Moscow Mitch, and you've seen a lot of Republicans call him that. That's an even bigger contrast. It's like, I was in the Marine Corps, I served my country admirably, I'm running as a public service, and this guy's literally, his nickname's Moscow Mitch. So not only is he not representing just Kentucky values, he might not even be representing American values.
I may have said words to that effect on the campaign trail, in fact.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's impossible to miss it. It's like you got one guy who's a literal farmer and a Marine and a substitute teacher, which I used to be a substitute teacher. That's one of the most thankless jobs you'll ever have. So nobody can say, hey, Mike Breuer, he's doing this for the glory. He'd be like, yeah, you know, the substitute teachers, they got paid like $100 a day or something like that. But you look at that and think, that's about as American as it gets, running against a guy who's been in the Senate for 36 years and is now being called Moscow Mitch. I mean, it contrasts. You can contrast you quite clearly. You know, you can't say you have a ton of overlap.
No. there's an awful lot of daylight between him and I.
Go to MikeForKentucky.com and sign up or volunteer or send money or whatever you can. And I appreciate your time, Mike, and I wish you luck on June the 23rd.
Well, thanks, Brody. And I'll tell you what, if you ever want to talk Kentucky or anything else, we'll set it back up. I'll be happy to come back on. But thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and stay tuned for the next episode.